We got Billy Contreras here, our special guest today, here live at Fiddle Hell. My name's Andy Reiner.
Hi, Andy.
The River of Zuck podcast theme music. Oh, yeah. Coming to you live from Colorado. Billy Contreras live from Nashville, Tennessee. Welcome, friends. Welcome to everyone joining us live at Fiddle Hell Online. And welcome to our special guest, Billy Contreras. How are you doing, man?
Doing good. How are you doing, Andy?
Well, I'm just really excited that we're all here, you know, together. And I'm excited to ask some questions. I want to get inside your brain a little bit, see what's going on when you play
right
music.
Yeah.
Well, I want to start a little bit with your superhero origin story of, like, how did you go from, like, a little kid to, like, the Billy Contreras we see today? Because I remember being a little kid at, like, Fiddle Camp in Tennessee, and we were like the same age. About, I was like 11, you were probably like 12 or something, and you were playing in the, like, staff instructor concerts then. Like, what happened to you? How did you become Billy Contreras?
Oh man, well, I think just as far as, you know, playing growing up, you know, spending a lot of time with Buddy Spiker, and the way he kind of worked on music with me was just kind of like, I just go over and hang out with him, and he'd just be working on whatever he's working on, and then he'd just get me to kind of help him with whatever he's working on. So yeah, just kind of got thrown into, songs and improvising and figuring out harmonies and playing in bands, kind of just at a really young age. And I feel like working with Buddy was just kind of something, you know, there wasn't any pressure, but it was kind of like, you just kind of long for the ride, so you kind of just try and keep up. And so I feel like that's really, it was really fun just to kind of, have to try and just keep up and, keep your head above water.
So how old were you when you started hanging out with Buddy Spiker? And for anyone who doesn't know, Buddy Spiker is, like, on, like, probably thousands of records, right?
So yeah, like, man, when he was doing his most sessions, like, probably, like, in the 60s and 70s, he was doing, like, 3 a day, like, every day, just, like, day after day. So like, that's a lot of records. And, I met Buddy when I was, like, 8 years old. When we kind of really connected was just through a friend of mine, one of my best friends growing up was Frazier Moss, this old fiddle player from Tennessee. And he was friends with Buddy, so kind of really connected with Buddy over at a jam session over at Frazier's house. And really just went to Buddy because he would teach me Orange Blossom Special, and the person I was taking lessons with then wouldn't teach me Orange Blossom Special. So, But then the first tune Buddy actually ended up teaching me was Whispering, which is like an old jazz standard. And it's like the contrafact is Grooving High, that's over that jazz standard. But yeah, I think I was 8 when I started hanging out with Buddy, and started playing in his band when I was about 10. And just working on a lot of music with Buddy, just arrangements and twin fiddle stuff. And then, just kind of watching his process of making music was really interesting and fun.
That's kind of that age where, like, you don't worry about at all about, like, what other people think, because you don't have that, like, self-awareness of, like, my actions affect other people.
Yeah, and you have no, like, scale of, like, what's, like, normal or, like, you know, what's, like, expected of, you know, someone to learn at a certain age or, like, any of that stuff, you know. So, young, I feel like, when people learn stuff young, it's kind of just wide open, you know. Just whatever they're exposed to, they pick up.
How do you think that changes when you get older?
I don't think it has to change, but But I think the two things that change a little bit is you just have so many more like social constructs that inform your like decision making that can like sometimes get in the way. You know, basically like herd mentalities. Like when you're young, you kind of just go wherever. But like, as you get older, you're like, oh, maybe I'll check this out because all these people are checking this out, you know? And which like growing up, I always tried to like check out, try and do the opposite. Like, well, if everybody's going over here, I'm going to like try and go over there. But then I think also just when you get older, you just have less time. So like, I think that partly, you know, plays an impact in, you know, just kind of like, yeah, your focus in like when you're learning things, that kind of deal. But
super cool. Well, those are some nice words. Do you got a fiddle that handy there? I was wondering,
yeah,
do you want to just play us something to kind of introduce yourself musically?
Sure. Let's see here. Let me get it out here.
Maybe even like one of those tunes that Buddy taught you a long time ago.
Yeah, let me
whatever
see.
You want. Man.
I remember one of those. Yeah. Man, I'll play one of the first tunes that I probably learned with Buddy. I don't think it was like maybe the very first one or two, but something I probably learned within a year or two of hanging out with him. All right.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's it's cool to hear a solo version of that, because I know you've got a version of that that's recorded with the full band with Buddy, I think, right?
Man, if I had to guess, probably so. It's been a while, but I think so. Yeah.
All right. Well, you'll have to buy all of Billy's albums to find out which one it's on then. Sweet. Well, that's super cool, man. Yeah, really creative. You know what my favorite bit is? Like, you're good at playing notes, but you also know when to play rests. Like, rests sure mean a lot. And they make the notes mean more too. So
totally.
Well, I want to jump right into like what is the River of Suck and get your thoughts on how you see this. You know, the River of Suck is an imaginary river inside our minds, and we all have the multiple rivers of suck thanks to fiddler Katie Davis Henderson for making this crazy picture. So basically, you're here on one edge of the River of Suck. You're on your comfort shore. You're behind you's your comfort cave. It's where you do all the things you already know how to do, like comfort zone, easy. You got this. You don't have to think about it. No worries. And you can see on the other side your goals. You can see little tiny, far in the distance, tiny little versions of yourself who can do all the things that you wish you could do now, but you can't yet. But future you can. The problem is, in between our comfort shore, our comfort cave, is a raging river of suck filled with whitewater rapids, rocks, and thought piranhas, which of course are those beastly teethed thoughts that enter your brain and try to sabotage your good vibes as you try to swim your way through all the rapids and rocks to get to that other side of the goal. The idea basically is that you have to suck at something before you can be good at it, right? Like, people want to just be like, try something and be awesome now. But, you know, I'm a fiddle player. Billy, you're a fiddle player. We've got a lot of people listening live who play this instrument. This is one beast of a thing to tackle. So where do you see the River of Suck in your music, Billy?
Man, well, I'd say it was a lot of flooding, and I'm just trying to, man, build up, I guess, the dams to just like hold back the raging flood constantly. But yeah, I don't know, man. Yeah, I think I always am like really appreciative of like, times I like, might play bad on a gig or something, really, really like the River of Suck is just a great, learning opportunity. So, I always just try and really take advantage of that. But, the way I kind of think about it is like, just like having that recognition and like being able to like observe like a problem and like kind of deduct things about it and assess where you're at. It's just like a great place to begin like a journey. And I definitely think, having that awareness of like if there's, something you would like to improve on, and just really being observant about it in the beginning and just being like really kind of like Sherlock Holmes-ish about it, I feel like is a really good, like starting point, And yeah.
Do you think it's true you have to suck at something before you can be good at it?
Oh man. Yeah, I mean, yeah, anything. Yeah, I think so. Especially if you're talking about anything that takes skills, definitely. Let's something like that takes. Yeah, something that takes like a highly like hybrid of like mind and body like skill set, yeah, for sure. Yeah, definitely. And I have like some things I'm trying to work on right now. And I played a gig last night, and because the way I kind of look at it is, so you got like this starting point of like you're not very good at something, you suck at something. And, but now you've done the first step, which is like, you've made the observation and you're like, oh man, I'm not very good at that, which is like, I feel like a good starting point. And then you're like, okay, you know, like, why am I not good at this? You know, the deduction part, then the assessment kind of like, okay, you know, where am I at in this whole mix of things? So then I feel like the first like productive step is like learning about whatever it is you're sucking at, you know? So like whatever the concept is, whether it's like, you know, whatever type of, you know, small or big part of music, I feel like just learning about it. So like asking questions about it, studying it, like listening to musicians, reading books, learning music, learning songs, like anything you can do to learn about that kind of stuff, just getting it in your mind, you know, mulling it over in your mind, I feel like is that first kind of like investment in the relationship. And that, so yeah, just doing that broadly, I feel like is really good. So then the next step would be like, you know, after you learn about it and you get all this information and music, then it's like, okay, now I got to practice this, you know, on my instrument. And so, or I mean, sometimes you don't, like some people might just practice in their head or whatever, but fiddle's pretty tricky physically, you know, getting around. So practicing on the instrument is always good. And so, yeah, so then I like, it's like you take all these things you've learned and now you start applying them to the like really kind of reality, like, you know, just like hands-on, like practicing it, whatever it is, and just shedding all the things you learned, trying to like be able to execute them and all that stuff. So then there's that. And then the next step is like, okay, now how do I take these things I've learned? Now that I've practiced them, these things I've learned, and now how do I like perform well with them? So then the next step is like you go to your gigs, you go to wherever you are, whatever you're doing, performing stuff. Now that's like in absolute real time, not just based on your own time perception, but like mixing your time perception with like everybody else's. So it gets a little more realistic, you know? And so then that's like, okay, now it's like, now this is for real. And that's where like, it really like things slowly come together after like, you know, keep trying to, you know, you know, like the gig is like, now you're actually like, you know, out there on the streets riding your bicycle. And, you know, and so you gotta like watch out for cars now and like all kinds of stuff, you know, bad sidewalks. And so, yeah, you're like out of your backyard where you have, you know, like your manicured path and like, so, yeah. And then after you perform, then it all starts over and you observe and you deduct and you assess again. Okay, now where am I at after I've like made this kind of real now? And then you can either like kind of go back through the process and like keep honing it, or you can kind of like take it on to another level, go to the bridge per se with the concept. And now like, you know, start getting more creative with it and, you know, that kind of deal, getting into like higher organizational kind of structures and, starting to like, you know, like refine the areas that deal more with like how you communicate musically with other people and, how like what you're doing reflects, you know, musically on other people around you, that kind of deal. And, yeah, that's kind of like later in the tune or whatever, the bridge, the later themes. And then like the way I kind of think about it is, okay, that first stuff is kind of like, you know, your initial themes, you go to the bridge, you get, that's where you're just like, now I'm going to outer space with whatever concept it was originally. Now I want to just like, man, like the things we're talking about, little kids, like how they don't have any like social constructs really, maybe somewhat, you know, like trying to do that thing with whatever it was. Now you're not trying to like copy what you learned from somewhere else. Now you're trying to just be really creative with the concepts you learned or you originally want to learn about, but try and like really abstractify it and see where you can take it personally or in a unique manner. And usually like at that point, you're going to start getting so many ideas and information going that the next step will be like how to organize all this material in a coherent way that you can actually like utilize it and, you know, kind of have it on a simpler comprehension kind of level. But then after you do that, I feel like, okay, now you leave the bridge. Now you're back kind of like taking the song out and like not outside, but like ending it, you know, getting ready to play your last themes before it's over. And that's where I feel you get into like, okay, now you've got the basics of it. You know, your basic learning, practicing, performing, your, you know, now you got your, you know, transition to searching for more ideas and going to the bridge, getting more creative, getting higher organizational structures. And then, okay, now we're taking it, you know, back up, winding it down. And then it's like taking all that stuff. Now, how do like I take these ideas and communicate them, you know, to other people I'm playing music with to develop a conversation, kind of have that reflection. And then the last steps to me are like, okay, now you teach it to other people. And then that in itself is like a really, really, to me, interesting process, because you end up learning so much more about it by the point you can get to teaching something. Besides all the stuff you learn, when you start to teach something, you just get a bunch of different type of insights. And then the last thing is like, now you've like, you're at the end of it and you've made the realization that like sucking and not sucking is kind of like the same illusion, you know? And, but yeah, I don't know. That's just kind of like, but yeah, it can be a long process, man. Sometimes it'll take me like years to work on something. Sometimes it might not take that long, maybe just a little time, but sometimes, you know, some concept work I might like be years before I even like feel comfortable with them or whatever. And
yeah, totally. I want to come back. You said a little bit ago a phrase that I love. Like you said, you're talking about like investing in the relationship with your instrument. You know, a lot of people in this kind of internet age just want instant gratification. Like, I see that thing on the other side. I want it now. I want to be good at this. And then if it doesn't happen today, then they get discouraged. But you're talking about a years-long process from total unawareness to like student to taking it out to be able to teach it. Now, that's a much longer process than a lot of people are expecting. So is it possible that like expectations is one of the biggest issues here, like expectations of like how far can we come fast versus how far can we come if we're deliberate about our practice time and how we think about it, and then like way off in the future, which feels so far away, right? That can eventually happen, but we got it, those expectations, though. Maybe the expectations are the thought piranhas, right, in this case,
man. I think so. Yeah, I think the whole idea is to, you know, be involved in the process and not focused on the end, right? And so, I mean, basically what you get then is you get like detail along the way. And what I always find, you know, you might have some like big idea of like, I'm going to do this and this is where I want to be. Most of the times what I've found when I'm like, when I have something like that, even if I end up completing that goal, the stuff I've really gained along the way is stuff I could have never imagined, because kind of like taking it slowly, you know, I look at it like if you were, I'm trying to remember how I look at it now, but like, I think it's like the metaphor I always kind of think about it is if you're like an ant in a big city or something, or maybe it's the opposite, I forget, but where like, where, yeah, it's like where the things around you get a lot bigger and you get like smaller. I mean, like, I guess like time's going slower and you're not in a rush as much and you observe more and you kind of get more out of every little thing along the way. And you take the time to like, you know, just kind of really invest in each step. And I find you kind of just really, besides, you know, whatever you're maybe learning about, you know, learn it more in depth. You also end up just like, man, learning about all kinds of unrelated, subtly unrelated things that are really cool. But yeah, definitely, I think expectations end up really limiting your kind of like your journey in the end, you know, because you're putting a boundary on something that really doesn't need it. And
right on. I always come back to this quote from big mountain snowboarder Jeremy Jones. He says, "The journey is the reward." And I've been reading this 8-book series, The Dark Tower by Stephen King. And when you get to the end, it's just like, well, it was about the journey, not the ending. It was like, oh.
Nice.
Oh, man. 8 books later, I find out. I was just trying to find out what happened in the end, and it was not the ending that mattered. It was the path. The journey hilarious. Is the reward. Well, here's a question. You were talking about playing gigs and noticing things about your playing. Like, I'm curious, what are you working on right now? Where's your practice path, I guess?
Yeah, right now, man, that's an interesting question. 'Cause you know, we got two little kids and one on the way. And, so yeah, I don't get a lot of time, but I definitely have things I've like, you know, that I want to keep working on. Like, I have a few concepts that I've been working on for like every couple months I'll kind of work on a new concept. So I got one now I'm working on that's based around like conceptually around like castles, but it deals with like basically like motivic development. And so I've been working on that for a couple months now and just trying to get it more and more kind of compressed to a practical level that I can kind of, when I'm working on a tune, apply it faster. So that's kind of one of the big things I've been working on for the last few months. But I only might get maybe like an hour every week or something to work on it. So yeah, part of it is just kind of being organized. So like when you get that hour, can you like really chip away at it, you know? And so yeah, I kind of take it in steps, but that's something I've been really, really interested in working on. It's been really fun. I've had some really good success with it on some gigs, parts of it. So I'm trying to just piece that like machine better form together. And
Well, congrats on the kids and the family, and obviously like life work balance, like that's its own river of suck. But like you're talking about smart practice, like if you're saying you might only have an hour a week, but you make that hour count, that could be better than like, you know, 3 hours a day of just playing and hoping it gets better.
Totally. Yeah. So with this concept, I like have a
What is a castle?
So yeah, with that, like, yeah, if you have like, you know, just a little castles. Bit of time to practice, trying to be real thoughtful about it. So yeah, like I keep really good notes of everything. And like when I'm working on a concept, I usually piece it together. So I'll keep notes for a while, try and compress a few things. And so like this castle thing has like seven kind of steps. So the first one is like you, whatever tune you're working on, you pick a handful of motifs that have like a certain amount of built-in differentiation to them. So they have different characteristics. Like a simple example would be just picking a motif. Each motif has a different amount of notes. Automatically, it's going to make it have different features in. So the first thing I do is like just getting motifs. The second step deals with like perceptions of those motifs. So like I might like just deal with the contour of the motif and exploring things like that, or maybe just the rhythm of the motif and abstracting ideas from that, or maybe just the shape of it, maybe just the phrasing of it. So the second step I deal is with like different perceptions of the same motif, and I'd go through each one of them, but like if it was just one motif, I might go through four or five different perceptions. So then I have a lot of different ideas from a single source that also go like very different directions. It could be like, you know, taking, you know, the third step deals with textures of it. So now I take these motifs with their perceptions and I add all these different either left-hand textures, say something like a ostinato or a double stop, or I take a right-hand texture, so maybe something like bow crossing, or maybe something like staccato type of notes, you know, something like that, and add these textures to these perceptions of these different motifs. So then the next step is what I call towers. So they're like these towers of the castle, which is like you put the motif in the tower, and the tower basically gives you the context of how the motif is like focused on. So now you're working on what's around this motif, meaning like, is the motif like a recurring motif? Is it a repeating motif? Is the motif set up some type of hinge off of it? All these different ways of exploring the context of the motif now. Then the next step deals with movement and how you get from one motif to another. Like, do you just go from this one to that one? Do you, you know, all the different type of movements? Is it fragmented? Is it some type of hinge? Is there some type of movement dealing with non-motif? So like, is it motif and then like non-motif material? Anyways, movement from one motif to another, and you can give it more like kind of complex movements or form. And then the next step deals with the non-motif stuff. So I call that pathways. And now I work on like how to create these pathways that are non-motivic material, but still have like kind of direction. And so they give you like these like movements if you want to break out of the motivic material and just go off these other pathways. And then the last step is you put all this into like architecture or form. So different types of forms, whether it be like theme and variation, and you're moving things around with different contexts, like same motifs, or like more kind of sophisticated forms. But yeah, so what I do is when I have really limited time, I pick a tune and I just kind of start at step one. Maybe I get through that, and maybe the second step in the hour. Next time I come back a week later, start at number three. And you know, okay, I got through that. Now I'm gonna pick up where I left off. Now I'm gonna, you know, get into the context of the towers, and then maybe going from one motif to another. So part of that is just like being kind of goodly well organized if you're gonna have like a lot of time off, you know, between practicing something. But I feel like it helps anyways, even if you're practicing, you know, every day. I really feel like organizing and kind of you know, making that a, you know, slightly big part of practicing, I feel like can really go a long ways. And I know definitely when you don't have a lot of time, it can help. Because when you come back, you're like, what? Like, what was going on a week ago? And, but if you, I keep really good notes, I can kind of be like, oh yeah, I forgot about that. And, you know, and it's kind of like, oh, okay, here's where I'm at. Now I do this and this. And, yeah, so I don't know if that answered the question or not, but
sure. Well, it actually answered my next question, which is like, what do you think about when you're playing music? And this idea of castles and towers, and like you're keeping like track of a lot of things at once. And I know a lot of people like worry about what, especially when it comes to improvising, like what other people think. They'd like worry about like how they're being perceived by other people. I'm wondering, like, do you just have so much that you're thinking about that you just tune all that out? How does that work?
I would say yes and no. I mean, like, it's all kind of like, man, what day is it? How am I feeling today?
Yeah.
You know, what have I been doing? You know, and, but ideally, I like to think about like really concepts that I consider like really productive to playing music. And I like to kind of focus on those as like gateways to like accessing nice musical moments with people. And, but yeah, definitely like, what did you say a minute ago? What was the word you used for like when you know, like you're like, oh, what, you know, what did the audience think of what I just played?
Yeah, the thought piranhas. That's a thought
piranha. Yeah, like the thought piranhas and that kind of stuff. It's not good. Any of the like self-validation type of thought processes really aren't, you know, productive to like creating good music. So yeah, you know, obviously, you know, thought processes, like, you know, it's gonna be whatever. So like trying to always maintain like good stuff in there is, I feel like, the best way to kind of like, you know, if you're having a, you know, issue with like, you know, oh man, you know, the audience is like, you know, completely bored out of their mind. You know, like, like that's not gonna really help. So at least like, you know, I feel like your best bet is just kind of having productive concepts to what you're doing. And some of that goes back to just practicing, you know, and having that kind of stuff available. And for me, a lot of times I like to work on this stuff, especially for when I'm not playing very well. You know, that's when it really helps. Sometimes, man, you're just in a good mood and you're like feeling really good. You got a lot of energy And like, you know, you just like, you can just like kind of play well and it's not a lot of work. And ideally that would happen all the time, but it doesn't.
It doesn't happen every day.
No.
Every day.
So that's where like all the stuff you practice, that's like the reason for it, I really think, you know, having those things available when, you know, when things aren't going perfectly and stuff. But
right on. I want to talk about comfort zone for a second. Like when you're on stage, do you play within your comfort zone, the easy comfort cave, comfort shore, or are you stretching and taking risks? And like, how do you manage risk? You're in Nashville, everyone wants you to be like clean and awesome, but you've also got some solo gigs, I think you're playing, right?
I was for a while, doing a lot of my own stuff. I hadn't in a while. Those are all like, really interesting things to balance. And
Michael Lucarelli in the chat saying that he's quoting you saying, always be on the cutting edge of yourself.
Yeah, there you go. I'm like, that is, I would say ideally, on gigs, like I'm usually trying to like go for things as much as possible. It also depends on the gig, you know, like sometimes like I have gigs where like it's a lot of times it's a balance. And I think like sessions are a really good example of that. Cause like my approach to sessions most of the time is like, how can I fit in with everybody, make the environment better, and also be as unique as I can and as like fresh new water as I can. Yeah, I definitely think pushing yourself is like the key to just like just kind of staying healthy musically. And but I think sessions are really interesting because that's, I feel like, right in the middle. You know, I will say sometimes, like, on my own gigs, you know, sometimes I push too far. And, like, I remember one time I was playing a song and, like, it's like my left and right hand were, like, off by a little bit. But, like, in my mind, it was, I knew it didn't sound good. But, like, in my mind, it was, like, going so well. I'm like, dude, I'm not going to stop. You know, like, it's, like, going well, even though I'm not actually executing what's happening. And so like, you know, that would be kind of like an extreme example of like, you know, pushing it. But sessions I think are really fun because you kind of have that balance of like, you know, having the whole goal of it is to like uplift the song. And so keeping that as your focus, but as well trying to like be as, you know, kind of creative as you can. And and that's what I really feel like is like cutting edge is like creativeness and, you know, kind of like fresh approaches and, you know, getting rid of the expectations like you're talking about, you know.
Yeah.
And I'd say definitely you know, that is, I think sometimes with my nature, sometimes I have to like, you know, just kind of like balance it out sometimes, you know, depending on what gig it is. And
right, some things you just got to play it safe and it's not about you.
yeah and also like, you know, little, you know, and the thing I like about sessions is you find like there's always a way to like break open some angle of something, you know. So maybe it's like, okay, maybe, you know, harmonically it has to be like really maybe non-tense, but maybe texturally it can be like wide open, you know.
Cool.
Or maybe movement wise it has to be like very like non-movement oriented, but maybe like the sounds can be like really, you know, more like options and stuff. So yeah, a lot of times it's like also like what angle can I slice off to like really explore my creativity in. And cool. So yeah, definitely I feel like, you know, that can be a big part of it too. you know, yeah, focusing on what whole kind of thing are you going to really kind of go for something. And yeah, and I feel like that's something I really kind of learned from watching Buddy. Like, the vibe I would always get from him when he was improvising was just like, just kind of going for whatever, you know. And I really like that. It's just, it's really fun to be around, and it's really kind of just like, I feel like joyous kind of like human experience and stuff. And wow. Yeah.
Now you've figured out a lot of, like, you know, crazy stuff on the fiddle, fast stuff, slow, like double, beautiful double stops, triple stops. You're all over the fiddle. Like, do you think at this point, learning all the things that you've learned, are you an expert, or are you just still a beginner and there's so much more to go?
Oh man, dude, I'm like, yeah, complete beginner, man. Like, I mean, yeah, like, yeah, very, very much so. So yeah. And like, you know, when you're younger and you come to those realizations that you really don't like know a whole lot, it can sometimes be unsettling. But like, the older I get, it's like, I feel like it's a great place to go, because you realize like, it's never going to end, or you're never going to like run out of things, you know? And yeah, so I feel like it's a good place to be, because it leaves a lot of options, a lot of different places you can, you know, check out. And, but yeah, definitely feel like I'm beginner. Yeah, one, just because, yeah, there's just so much out there to learn about. And two, because even I feel like I'm fairly organized, but man, I forget a lot of stuff too. So like, yeah, you're like, man, you might have had this one concept, you know, a few years ago, and then like, man, it kind of, you know, you still have probably some things of it, but just the nature of it, you know, like, what do they say? Like, you know, you get like, you know, new hair every like 5 or 6 years or something. You just don't have what you had, you know? And, so yeah, I think in music, it's somewhat like that, you know, you have somewhat of a, like, you know, like the Sherlock Holmes, a finite amount of space in your brain attic. So like, you know, you can't fit everything, you know, it's gonna just, you know, so. But yeah, so for those two reasons, like, if you could, you know, keep everything you ever got always at the present moment, man, that would be like, yeah, you know, I might, you know, you might be more like at a medium level, but, you know.
But that's not how brains work.
Yeah. Yeah. That fact alone is kind of like, yeah, it can be, you know, difficult. So it's good to go back and review stuff. And that's one reason I like to keep good notes, so I can go back and, you know, check out things I might have forgotten about. But yeah. Oh man, one thing I was thinking, we were talking about a minute ago, with that whole like why it takes so long to like get good at something. Yeah. And what I've noticed is, man, it's just like, it's basically you're restructuring your neural pathways kind of. And I think that process in itself, like, literally just takes like 4 or 5 years. And like, and like, So I think it's like, it's just kind of like inevitable. It's not like, oh, I'm not working hard enough, or like, I'm not practicing good enough. I think it's kind of just like what it is. I don't know. I could be totally wrong, but it seems like, yeah, just like, you know, when you're building neural pathways to like create certain decision-making, and especially I think as you get older and you've already created other ones, and now you're trying to like replace them and like, you know, put a roadblock here or maybe a detour there, you know, all that kind of stuff, you know, like, I think it just, yeah, it just takes time. And that is one good reason, you know, practicing slow, trying to get the good habits the first time around, can save time in the long run, because you have less like road work to do later, you know, to clean up those pathways and stuff, make them less bumpy or whatever. But
I dig it. Appreciate it. Hey, we got some questions from the chat. We don't got a ton of time, so I'm wondering, let's call this a lightning round for a second.
Yeah.
how do you work through performance jitters?
Season. Man. Oh my gosh.
I guess that's a big question.
That is, I would just say the easiest thing to do is have like musical concepts you're really interested in. That's something that helps me. So if I can focus on things that I want to play or concepts that I want to explore musically, it kind of doesn't leave room for the other stuff.
Focusing on the joy, like the excitement. Yeah.
Yeah. And then also, yeah, that's the other thing, man, just taking it and also kind of just going with it sometimes instead of like trying to push it away, just trying to like be like, oh man, it is what it is. And just like kind of go with it and even kind of explore that aspect sometimes can help, you know, just bringing it in and like, you know, filtering it as opposed to kind of putting too much energy towards it.
Yeah, it's part of it. All right. What's your favorite tune, Heather?
Asks. Oh my gosh.
Heather, that's an insane question.
Whoa, yeah, that's a hard one. Man, oh my gosh. Wow. Oh man. Oh, I think probably like, man, my favorite tune would either be like the Human Heartbeat or like just any bird song.
Yeah. Man, that's an incredible answer. And thanks for bringing the bird sounds to this this interview. I've appreciated hearing them. Okay, this is our last lightning round question. How often do you change your strings and what strings are you playing on these days? From Bobby. Man.
Well, in the past, I've had an endorsement with D'Addario, and I've really liked their Kaplan Vivo heavy strings are probably my favorite. So I like the Ammos too, but in general, I probably like the Vivos better. They're a little bit louder, and I definitely like the heavies, I've noticed. Changing strings, I mean, it depends, but like I would say if you're talking like over the course of my life, I generally don't change strings until they break. And they just got to be like, if they're like really awful and I have like, you know, a good session coming up or something, I might change them. But even I feel like a good mic in a good room and a good fiddle will like kind of make up for the bad strings. And so I've definitely like ended up on some gigs with like two strings before, but
right on. Well, man, Billy, we only have 4 minutes left because we gotta keep things moving along here at Fiddle Hell. I just want to say before we run out of time, I really appreciate you being here and answering some of these like tough questions about music and life.
Yeah, thanks for having me, man. This was really fun.
So where can people find your music in the world? Where can we buy CDs? How do we follow you?
Man, I think the only CD I have for sale, I think me and Buddy have our CD called By Request, which you could buy at CD Baby. We had some printed up and then our other CD printed up, but I don't have any left of them. And but I think you can still get that By Request at CD Baby. And as far as buying music, I think that's kind of pretty much it. And then I got some, you know, stuff on YouTube from like, you know, live gigs that, you know, people have recorded, a couple like videos I made with people. So just kind of, you know, the normal YouTube. Oh, I do have a lot of music from a gig I did. I did a gig for a couple of years down the street from my house. And a lot of that music is like iPhone recording up on archive.org. But there's a lot of my own music up on like those recordings of, I think it's archive.org. A lot of my original music. Did a bunch of classical music, like in a jazz style. Just kind of a bunch of different stuff up there. Not the greatest sounding, but you know, if people want to kind of check out the music I write and stuff, you know, you can hear it up there.
Totally. Well, I hate to say, can you play one more, can you play your fiddle for one more minute just to take us out?
Yeah. Let's see here. I'll play a little tune here. ¶¶
Billy Contreras, everyone. Thanks again. My name is Andy Reiner. This is River of Suck Podcast Live. Thanks for tuning in live at Fiddle Hell or for listening in the future. We appreciate you all.
Yeah.